Hello and welcome to Graduate Theory. On today's episode, you'll hear about what it means to take an asymmetric risk and certain things you can do in your career that have unlimited upside. We'll talk about networking hacks from Chinese culture, and we'll also talk about what it means to challenge yourself appropriately. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to the Graduate Theory newsletter. You get takeaways and my insights from this episode directly to your inbox every single week. Without further ado, please enjoy. Hello and welcome to Graduate Theory. My guest today is a serial entrepreneur, problem solver, and country man. He's an active member of the Australian startup community, and he's been a part of several capital raises and writes about startup funding on his site, startupfunding.com.au. He's passionate about helping young people and growing the Australian startup ecosystem. Please welcome to the show, Warwick Donaldson.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me. Very excited.
Great, man. I'm really, really excited to chat as well. Before the podcast, we were speaking about your first job and how that came about. And I'm curious, you know, what was your very first job and how did you get that?
Well, I've actually had a few first jobs, so it depends which first job we're talking about. So I'll tell all three. Yeah. All three are kind of fun.
Okay,
cool. So my first job was actually when I was about 6 years old, and I used to get, I think, $1 or $2 a week pocket money from my parents, and it wasn't enough. I always wanted to buy things, and my parents wouldn't give me any money, and so I devised a way to make some more money. And so basically my first ever job, my first ever business was actually collecting sheep poo. So I used to walk around picking it up, put it in bags, and then I used to sell it to people in town because I grew up on a farm. So that was my very first. And then I suppose I created that job. My first job working for someone else was actually working on a farm for my dad. And so that was when I was about 10 years old. And he used to get me doing proper full days because I really wanted to do it. So he used to pay me, like, you know, half reasonably well. He's like, oh, well, you do a full day's work, then you get paid like a, you know, a normal person. And but my first job, which I think you're referring to, out of, well, maybe I'll tell the backstory to that. So basically, ever since I was about 14, I was fascinated in finance and I really wanted to be in banking. My idea was that banking was kind of the pinnacle of I think capitalism and sophistication, and I thought that I was going to be exposed to the most amazing things in the world there, and I'd be challenged, and I'd get to see billions of dollars and all this sort of stuff. And so that absolutely fascinated me. So ever since I was 14, I wanted to go into banking, and so I went to uni and I studied banking, finance, and accounting. And then when I graduated with, you know, pretty average grades. I didn't fail anything. That's probably my claim to fame out of my uni degree. But my grades, I don't think were good enough to get into a grad position. So I tried and didn't get in anywhere. But I wanted to be in banking. And so I said, okay, well, I'm just going to get a job in banking, doing anything, and figure it out once I get there. So I actually got a job in outbound credit card collections call center. And so I spent about 9 months there. And so basically while I was there, what I did was every day I would get on the GAL, the global address list, and I would research people in ANZ that I thought were working in interesting departments. And I would send them emails and I'd say, hey, I'm really interested in what you do. I want to learn more. Do you have time to go and get a coffee? And slowly I worked my way through like credit risk, market risk, kind of, you know, the traders and all different parts of ANZ. And everybody said yes. And they were really pleased that someone would reach out to them and ask them questions and want to learn about them and what they do. And so I did that for about 8 or 9 months, and each of those people would go and refer me to someone else who they thought was working in an interesting department based on what I would tell them about what I wanted to do. And so I ended up kind of working my way through ANZ, and eventually I made my way to ANZ's treasury. And so those of you who are not familiar, treasury is basically the bank's bank, and so they're the ones who ensure that the bank is funded, and they dish the funds out to the various business units and manage liquidity. So I found someone in ANZ's treasury, and he's like, well, we've never had anyone find us. This is actually really cool. We're actually hiring a grad role as an analyst. Are you interested? I said, hell yeah, yeah. And it was the interviews and got my first, you know, quote unquote, real grad job, I suppose. Yeah, which was an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, that's really cool. I think that's such a good story. I think it really speaks to this idea of, like, you know, you're reaching out and then, like, people are so surprised almost to have someone reach out to them. And then, like, there's it's such a valuable thing to do for yourself and like, for them. It's just, I think, like, reaching out cold like that, you know, I think that's a great example of how valuable that it can be. Because I think too many of us, you know, don't do that. I don't think. Yeah. I think, like, you know, you're almost worried, like, oh, what if they say no? Or what if, like, this or this or this or whatever? But, like, you know, what if they said yes? You know what I mean? And that's a great example of how it can work out if you persist with that kind of thing.
Well, that's the best bit, right? Like, the worst they can do is say no. The best they can do is say yes, and you end up getting a job. Yeah. Like, you know.
Yeah.
There's no downside, yeah. And there's only upside. So, you know, it's a pretty good risk to take, if you want to call it a risk at all.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, yeah, I was reflecting on this idea, like, through probably the last week, of just how many people that I've met that have this, like, commonality of them, you know, look, like, their opportunity that's, you know, been something that really changed their life was just something that they wanted to do and they asked for it, you know, and then suddenly they were, like, you know, off doing something incredible. And I just think it's something that's really, really common, and it's something that's underappreciated, or, you know, people just don't do that enough, and they don't even realize perhaps what you can achieve just by asking.
Yeah, and I think I never underestimate someone's willingness to talk about themselves. People love talking about themselves. You know, we gather a lot of experience in our life, and a lot of people love to share that experience. And you know, that's why I'm doing this interview, right? And that's why, like, I take every cold outreach nearly that you know, people make to me, because I love sharing my experiences, and hopefully someone can learn from me, because, you know, I've done all this stuff, and then hopefully I can short circuit some learnings for the next person. And that's kind of what it's all about, right? So
yeah absolutely. Yeah, I just think it's so powerful. And yeah, it's like people like yourself who are so open to people reaching out as well is what, you know, what makes this work as well. So I'm sure, like, I appreciate it, and I'm sure other people that have reached out to you appreciate it as well. I want to move on now with your career and move into, you know, you went overseas in your career. You went to, talk us through that process and kind of what led to you deciding to go over there.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was working at ANZ. I'd spent about 2 years in treasury at that point in wholesale fund. We were managing a portfolio of bonds. It was about a bit over $100 billion, and it was crazy. And we're doing $25 billion of new issuance per year. And it was absolutely insane, right? And I loved the work, and I loved the markets and all this sort of stuff. But there was really something missing. And I think I saw my life flash before my eyes. I kind of saw where I was going to be when I was 40 and 50, because, you know, the progression seems rather linear, or it did when I was there anyway. It seemed quite linear, and I think that scared the shit out of me, and I was like, oh my God, what happens if I spend the next 30 years at ANZ or in banking? Like, you know, would I be happy? Would I say that I've lived a full life? And up until that point, my life had always been about risk management. So grew up on a farm. You know, farming is about extreme risk management, and then, you know, studied banking, finance, and accounting, which is also risk management, right? And so I felt that I wasn't really taking risks with my life. And, you know, part of that is to do with my privilege, and then part of that is to do with, like, the way I grew up and kind of, you know, Australia and all that sort of stuff. And Australia's a pretty safe place to be. And I wanted to experience a bit more about the world, and I didn't take a gap year or anything like that. So I said, okay, it's time for me to challenge myself, like, really challenge myself. Like, what's the most extreme thing I can do to challenge myself without taking too much risk, right? Like, you know, I'm still a person who likes to manage risk. And so I came up with this idea of moving to China. I'd been there twice on holiday and really enjoyed it, and it kind of felt like a second home. But I didn't speak Chinese. I didn't know a whole lot about Chinese society. All I knew is that for some reason I was drawn to it. And so I said, okay, well, like, you know, it's probably the biggest risk that I could take. I talked to this guy who moved there a couple of years before. He's like, just do it, man. Like, what's the worst that could happen? I was like, all right. My dad's like, oh, I don't know about this. And everyone at ANZ is like, I don't know why you would be doing that. You literally have one of the best jobs in the world right now, you know. And so I did it. I decided I quit and I got a job teaching English in a primary school in kind of the suburban Nanjing. And Nanjing's basically, I know a comparator is probably like Geelong, right? It's 10 million people, but it's still kind of like a big country town. And I was right on the outskirts and the suburbs there. And I went and taught English. And that kind of started my journey in China. I ended up spending 3 years there. And it was a crazy time. And it was a time that really challenged me. And it challenged me in really good ways. It challenged me to understand that there is a completely different world out there. And the parameters that we don't quite understand the parameters that guide us in, say, Australia or in the West. We think that we take for granted certain things that exist in Australia as like, this is just the way it is. And we don't really challenge those things. And then when you go to a place like China, it's built on a completely different set of rules and technology and culture. All of a sudden you realize all these things that you thought were just had to exist no longer had to exist. You know, for example, like I moved there in 2016 and everybody was on WeChat and literally every payment was instant. You know, coming from Australia where like, you know, and just because the Chinese banking system's built on a completely different set of rules and that's what society demanded, and they kind of skipped the PC age and went straight to the smartphone age You know, they're just basic things that really challenge what we kind of accept here in Australia as normal or like slow progression.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting to hear that. And I'm even curious to hear, you know, around your decision to move is something that is interesting to me, because it's something that, you know, like you said, you're in sort of the typical, like, this is a great job, like doing well in like the corporate kind of sphere. And then you're sort of giving that up to go and do something which, you know, people consider, okay, that's probably not as good of a job, right? Being a teacher in sort of like a remote place in China. Like, what is how did you deal with that? I mean, was there any, like, did you feel like sort of social expectations on doing that? Like, you know, in sort of or were you just kind of like, yeah, like, you know, I mean, I'm curious to hear, like, did you doubt yourself at any point through that process, or were you just kind of, yeah, whatever, like, this is what I want to do, so I'm just going to go straight for it?
Yeah, no, I it took me 6 months to like basically make the decision and figure out how I was going to do it with the least amount of risk possible. And I doubted myself a lot. But I think, you know, that the fact that I was doubting myself a lot meant that I was probably taking the right level of risk and challenge. Because if you're not doubting yourself, then you're probably not pushing yourself hard enough, right? You're feeling too safe. And so you just kind of need to fight through it. And I mean, really, you know, the risk was pretty low because, like, worst case scenario, like, I end up leaving China after 6 months, a year, and I go back into banking, like, back to Australia into banking, right?
Mm.
Best case scenario, I discover and evolve and learn into this amazing person and have all these experiences which make me a better person. You know, it's not like I can get a job in China teaching English, it's really easy. And so the risk is relatively low, but I did doubt myself a lot. And, you know, I was quite conscious of the fact that people were judging me based on this. And my dad's like, oh, this is really a good idea. You know, like, are you sure? You know, he doesn't know much about China. And you know, that the reason why I was going is because like one of the reasons why I was going is because China is in the paper every day and it's this like massive influence on our society. But I didn't know anything about it. All I knew was like, you know, how it was portrayed in the papers. And obviously, you know, if anyone who's ever traveled, you know that how somewhere, a culture, a country or whatever is portrayed on paper is obviously extraordinarily different to how it is in real life. And that's why we travel, right? To challenge these learnings, these perceptions that we have and, you know, put some substance behind them. And so, you know, it was, yeah, I doubted myself a lot, but whatever. I pushed through and now I'm like, you know, now I'm this white dude who can speak Chinese cruising around Australia and like, you know, I pull it out all the time and people are like, oh my God, you can speak Chinese, like speaking to Chinese people. And it was really nice. And it's like, you know, you can bond over it and I can understand a different culture and society. And I really appreciate that. And it's really propelled me as a person, but a career as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm interested to hear that, you know, those, you mentioned those, the cultural differences there, and obviously like going to a different country, you know, that's, you know, you get to see those differences, but then coming back to Australia, like I'm interested to hear like how you ended up coming back and then even, you know, what kind of lessons or what were the things that you really took from your that experience in China, you know, back with you to Australia?
Yeah. So I came back twice. So the first time I spent 2 years there and I wasn't progressing as fast as what I wanted to. And I was a little bit frustrated and I was like, oh, I'm going to be a teacher forever. Like, this is kind of really annoying. I want to get back into doing some the work that I love in finance. And so I came back to Australia and so I came back to Australia actually really not knowing much Chinese because I'd kind of fallen into maybe what a lot of people do when they move overseas. Unless you really like want to challenge yourself, you fall into the crowd that speaks kind of a common language. And so, you know, I end up spending a lot of time with people who spoke English, both locals and expats. And so I came back and I tried to make it work in Australia and I got a couple, you know, really good jobs and I just wasn't really settled. And it was really hard coming back because I'd had this like crazy phenomenal experience and like, you know, the way that I lived and everything had changed forever and nobody could kind of understand that. And, you know, everything was kind of the same here. And so it was really difficult coming back. And so I got a really, really good job in venture capital. And after about 5 months, they asked me, they said, so, you know, are you enjoying yourself? Do you see yourself here for a while? And I said, honestly, no, I don't. And they're like, oh, And I couldn't believe I was saying that because I really wanted to work in venture capital. I was working with startups, I was working in finance, and it was get to talk to founders all day and all this sort of stuff. And it's great. It was amazing. But I just wasn't excited about it. All I could think about was China. And so I ended up leaving and going back to China. And I said, all right, if I'm going to go back to China, this time I'm going to do it properly. I'm going to learn Chinese. I'm going to take the time. I'm going to put the effort in. And so I went back, but I went back and enrolled in university full time, studying Chinese. And so we had 5 hours of class 5 days a week. And then we'd have probably another 4 to 5 hours of homework a day, like rote learning Chinese. So it was like literally writing Chinese characters and pronouncing tones and doing conversation and reading and like, you know, all this sort of stuff. And it was really intense and I loved it. And it was, and so I felt like I was kind of going back to finish off something that I started that I didn't do properly. And it was amazing. And then kind of 12 months in to studying, I realized how long I was going to have to study to get my Chinese to a level where I could work, like in the areas, in the fields that I really enjoy. And it was probably another 3 to 4 years. And I really wanted to get back into that type of work. And also it dawned on me that once I get my Chinese to that level, that I would have to then rebuild my career in a different country with different rules. And So I decided, and you know, all this is because like Chinese culture is a very old, complex culture, like any culture in the world, right? And so you're not only learning the language, but you're learning the culture. And so you need to understand that sort of stuff. And so, yeah, anyway, basically after 12 months, I kind of came to the realization that it was probably a little bit too long, and I'd kind of got a lot out of the experience already. And so it was time to come home. And so I actually flew back into Australia 2 weeks before COVID was officially announced in China. So I flew back in on the 15th of December, and the 31st of December was when it was kind of announced or discovered. And actually, there were people with COVID 1 week later where I was working at the time. Wow. So I could have been patient zero if I went.
Yeah.
Just like insane to think, right? Yeah, like absolutely insane. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so cool. And it's really interesting because, people often talk about like Chinese being something that's like quite hard to learn. Like the language is something that, you really got to be, it's like probably one of the hardest languages to learn. And then, on top of that, learning the culture and then, doing all these other things. I think, I think it's a definitely great experience. It certainly sounds like it. I'm curious, what were some things that you, when you came back in end of 2019, when you came back to Australia, is there anything that kind of stuck from when you're in China? Like, is there any, sometimes it's like things like, there's certain like cooking techniques that they use or like, certain ways that you would like get ready or, those cultural things that, perhaps we, the way we do things in Australia is like a bit different. Is there anything that you took back, from there that you still do today?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, it influenced my life so much. Mm. Like my choice of breakfast, like I like to have a noodle soup for breakfast.
Yeah.
A hot bowl of noodle soup on a hot day. I like to drink warm and hot water. Picked up a lot of cultural things and as well as actually on the networking side. And I was going to leave this till the end, but in China they have something called Guangxi. Guangxi is the concept of relationship and the power of relationship. And so in China, it's extremely important. And I think through, a lot of Asia. And it basically rules society in a way, as I understand it. And this idea that, you build your relationships, but actually you build your network. But actually what you're doing is you should also be using those relationships and those networks. And so they say Guangxi is like an arm. The more you use it, the more powerful it gets. And I think this is a really important thing that kind of underpins how I conduct myself these days is I grew up in Australia where we build networks, but we use them as a last resort. We don't like to draw on our networks too much because we feel maybe a little bit embarrassed that we're asking for help. Where in China, it's the complete opposite. You should be using that as one of the first ports of call.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really picked up on this, and so I've really been trying my best to apply that in my daily life, and I'm seeing the benefits already. I talk a lot with people, the same people, or try to build up a good network of people and help each other. And I really feel that bond and relationship evolve and it gets more meaningful over time. And it's really enjoyable. One, because you're building relationships, which obviously as humans is like a basic thing, which is really nice.
Yeah.
But also you're helping each other, and that's also really nice in a professional sense as well as in a personal sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think like what you said there about like often we turn to our network as a last resort. Certainly like when you said that, I was like, oh, I definitely like, I'm definitely guilty of that. And yet certainly even taking it back to what we were talking about at the start with the reaching out and things like that, you can achieve so much from just asking. And often from what you've just said there, like you can save yourself a lot of time, try to work something out yourself when just asking someone could solve your problem really, really quickly. So I absolutely agree. I think that's something that I personally could do better, and likely a lot of people could do better is not being so worried to just reach out to people and ask for things, ask for help, ask for, you know, if people can help you. Because, yeah, I think it's something that could be beneficial for both parties, like you said. Yeah.
And I think you know, I know definitely the part of Australia that I grew up in is definitely a more individualistic society. And so we pride ourselves on doing everything ourselves, right? It's like, move out of home as soon as you're 18 and, like, you know, fight for your survival and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, not really fight for your survival. Yeah. It wasn't that bad, but
yeah.
but you know, like, really drive home as individual. And I know I kind of rejected my family for a long time, and it was only after, and that, this is really another thing that I came back with, was the importance of family and friends, and you know, Chinese society is very much centered around this family unit, and friends come within that, and that's really important. And so that's something that I came back from China with as well, really drawing in my family and embracing it and really enjoying it, which has been really nice and really refreshing, and not like thinking that I have to do everything myself just because I need to prove that I'm like a big tough person who can make it in Australia by himself. Like, it's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's something that we can all do. We can all do better. And yeah, certainly, like, I absolutely agree with that. Yeah, it's only, at least for myself, I'm like, okay, I could definitely improve in that area. So yeah. Okay, even like with the podcast, I'm like, you know, people will say like, oh yeah, you should like reach out to this person, like they'll be able to help you with this area. And then like part of me is like, yeah, that's a good idea, but I don't know why. It's almost just like, well, I almost like want to do it. Like, it's probably, it's like clearly like not the best way to do it, right? But I'm like, yeah, like I can do it all myself. Like person that has a newsletter that like they can share it with heaps of people, like, no, like I don't need that. Like, I'll be able to do it myself. Yeah. You know, and it's just like, wow, the amount of opportunities that like, yeah, that I that all of us have, not just me, but you know, that are just one ask away that you just completely ignore because like to do it yourself, I think is phenomenal.
Yeah. But also, like, you know, it's fun doing things by yourself and like making your own mistakes, and like that's okay, but just making sure that you find a balance, right? And especially seizing opportunities that are really like that are really juicy, and but also, you know, acknowledging the fact that you just don't know where an opportunity is going to lead, and so you may, on the face of it, an opportunity may not look that appealing or juicy, but you know, it may end up leading to, for example, a grad job like I got, right? And that was not what I was expecting, but that was what happened. And I suppose if I tried to judge that meeting or opportunity from the outset, I would have been completely wrong. And you know, actually, most of the time, I'm completely wrong when I try and judge outcomes of meeting people. People are very complex, and they're much more than their LinkedIn or their Instagram profile or whatever. And they have amazing networks and amazing knowledge, and you just cannot ever predict where something is going to go or what you're going to learn or like just their background. And that's the most beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's really daunting though, because like you have to be prepared to like for anything, to learn anything, to be exposed to anything. But that's what makes it so beautiful, especially if you have a love for learning, right?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. That's very wise. Certainly. I think that's, yeah, I think that's, like, that's so true. And I think, yeah, the love of learning is so important. Yeah, it's something that we can all do better at, I'm sure. I want to talk about now, like, your experience in the startup world, because this is something that you said you worked in VC for a little bit in between your trips to China. It's something that you're really involved with today. You know, how did you stumble into that area, and kind of what, you know, it's this similar trend of kind of life lessons. Is there anything that you've really, what have startups that were being in this space taught you?
Yeah. So, you know, as I said before, I started my first business when I was like 6, and I had a few businesses since. And then I started my first startup when I was 21, I think, when I was just coming out of uni, and I was starting at ANZ in Treasury, and I had an idea for a fitness marketplace. And so I was like, whatever, let's just try and build it and see what happens. And so I convinced my dad to give me a little bit of money, which he never saw again. He still teases me about today. He always asks me when I'm going to repay. Yeah. I wish I better get onto that, actually. It's a good reminder.
Yeah.
And so I started a fitness marketplace, and so basically went through the whole thing, finding some developers and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, after a year, it was kind of built, and I basically had grand plans for it to be the biggest and best thing from day one. And I launched it, and nothing, crickets. I had no idea what I was doing.
Mm.
And I kind of came to the realization after a couple of months that I'm going to have to get out and like pound the pavement and go and talk to people and all this sort of stuff. And I actually didn't care about a fitness marketplace. I'm saying I just did not care about fitness or marketplaces. It's just not me, right? And and so I kind of started this thing thinking I found like this niche, and I was going to be able to, because I'm a business person, I can just like execute anything, and like you know, it's irrelevant whether I care about it or not, which is just not true for me. And so I end up shutting that down because I didn't want to do the work, and basically that's what it came out. Oh, so many realizations coming out in this. And then about a year later, I started another startup called Godber and Warwick, and so basically it was a custom men's shoe business, and so it was design your own shoe in the shoes in 3D. It was modeled after Shoes of Prey, which I saw some people at work using, and I was like, oh my god, this is amazing. And I was kind of playing around with like custom design shoes at the time. We were going over to Vietnam on holiday and getting them made, and it was really fun. And so I was like, okay, well, I have to do this. And so I started building that, and that basically maybe for 3 years I was building this custom shoe business, and then when I was in China, I was still doing the same, and I met my really good friend Ola Gobba, and we joined up together, and he's a designer, and so we're having a lot of fun building this tech, and then we found a custom shoe manufacturer factory in China, and we used to go there on weekends and play around with these designs, and they thought we were absolute crazy. We were trying to get them to make the most crazy designs, and we found that they had a laser in the factory, and so we started like, you know, getting leather and lasering things on, and then we're getting friends who are tattoo artists like tattoo leather, and oh man, like, you know, we're doing all lots of crazy stuff. We're dyeing these shoes like hot pink, and like, you know, it was so much fun. And we tried that for like 3 years, and it didn't really come off. And I knew that I really loved change and innovation and startups. And so I went into the space and decided to go and work for anyone that was in the startup space. Basically, I just wanted to learn, and so that kind of started my startup career as a employee. And yeah, I've kind of, you know, now I work at Tractor Ventures, and it's an amazing place to work, and I get to meet founders all day every day, and I get to see all these innovations, and you know, whilst we're also a startup ourselves, we're actually a fintech. The name Tractor Ventures is a bit deceptive. We're actually a fintech company, and we also get to deal with startups who are innovating themselves. So it's kind of like the perfect job because it's also finance. So it's kind of amazing. But you know, I was like, before that, I worked in a medical device startup and doing finance. And before that, I worked in an ag tech SaaS startup called Mobile doing growth. And yeah, and while I was in China, I also did a lot of community work, building the expat community, and then started doing startup community work through Startup Grind, and then came back to Australia and was also doing Startup Grind. And I just really enjoyed community building, and it was, I don't know what it is about it. I think for me, I get really excited when I see two people meet each other for the first time, start sharing stories, and then all of a sudden you see something happen where they share some stories about problems they're trying to solve, and then the other person goes, "Ah, I did that 6 months ago, and don't do this, go and do this, and all of a sudden 6 months worth of learning has been shortcut over to the other person, and they don't have to spend 6 months like making mistakes, right? And there's something beautiful about that. All you have to do is like create this environment for these learnings to be shared, and you've just saved hopefully someone 6 months of like trying to figure out some stupid problem that, you know, and there's, I don't know, something electrifying about that, and seeing kind of relationships being built. And yeah, and so I've kind of been doing community work on the side ever since. It's kind of morphed these days into finance community work, where I have my website startupfunding.com.au, and I publish investors on there, investors and lenders for startups. And so it's been really great for me to learn about the early stage capital market space in Australia. And then I was like, well, this is not really enough. Like, you know, it's one thing having an investor list, it's another thing really knowing what to do with it or how to raise the money. And so then I started doing analyst reports and basically writing up reports for founders on metrics, on capital raising metrics, you know, like how, what's the median seed size raise in Australia, and how long between rounds, like, you know, how much capital should I be raising? Should it be 12 months? Should it be 18 months? Should it be 24 months? And so, yeah, I kind of did that for, still doing that today. And yeah, I find myself at Tractor and then writing articles on my weekends and doing a little bit of community work here and there. And I kind of forget what the question was. So
it's that's all right. Well, yeah, it's really cool how you've managed to like cover so many different areas through like the VC and the startup ecosystem in Australia. Because yeah, like you said, you're contributing with startup funding. You're doing community events, like helping founders, like all this kind of stuff. It's really great to see.
Yeah, and all that kind of comes back to literally, I just see a problem that's not being solved, some information that's not being shared, and I'm like, okay, well, I might as well do this and like just see what happens and whatever. And you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's got a pretty short attention span these days; they'll forget. So,
yeah, you know, it's all good. True. That's such a good way of looking at it. Hey? That's amazing. I want to ask, so you know, you touched on the custom shoe stuff, like didn't quite work out. You know, I'm sure you've seen many startups kind of start and be like, yeah, we're going to be amazing, and then things like didn't really work out so well. But I'm curious for yourself, has there been a failure in your life that turned out to be something that was really beneficial, or is a failure that turned out to be a success in some way?
Yeah, good question. So I think first it's important to define what I think a failure is. And so what I actually think a failure is I think a failure is when you try something, but you don't learn from it. And I've only realized this after working in experimental environments, which is like startups, right? So startups, by the very definition, are experiments in themselves. And only after being in an environment that encourages failure have I been able to embrace it and enjoy it. And so very much what's come out of that is that if you're trying something, if you're experimenting and it doesn't go the way that you hoped it would, but you learn something from it, then it's not a failure. But if you didn't learn anything from it, then it is a failure and you've kind of just wasted a bit of time, right? And so for me, that's how I would define a failure. And so with that in mind, all of a sudden, all these things that I've done in my life have actually not, they've been successes because I've learned a whole heap of things and they've contributed to my career, where I am today, who I am as a personality, you know, as a person and my personality and where I'll go in the future. So, however, you know, there are some failures that I have had, some failures as I define them. And I think my favorite failure, I was reflecting on this last night and I was like digging really deep to like discover this, you know. You heard it first here.
Yeah.
On Graduate Theory.
Yeah.
My favorite failure is not actively listening. And this is really painful to say, but you know, I've been quite guilty of not actively listening in the past. I don't think I'm very good at it. And I have been learning how to do it better. And so, you know, the result of that has meant that there has been some really valuable information that has been shared with me that I have not retained. And therefore, it's meant that I've gone and subsequently done things that I should have known would not have worked out. And so therefore, I've actually wasted time and kind of, you know, failed an experiment as such. As well, by not actively listening, I failed to have deeper conversations and therefore uncover more opportunities which could benefit both me and the person who were in that conversation or in that situation. So I think for me, not actively listening is my greatest failure.
Yeah.
Deep.
Deep, yeah, certainly. Yeah, I think that it is. It's a tricky thing to, you know, to solve. Almost is like is that kind of thing where, you know, listening and like yeah, actively listening can be something that's quite, you know, seems like it, you know, on the outside seems quite hard, perhaps, to something that you can improve on or something that you can really work on. Is there anything that like, you know, as a result of that you try and do now to sort of combat that listening process?
Yeah, I try to slow down. I like to move fast and think fast and you know, break things and all that sort of stuff. And I love change. And so it means that I am primed to be a poor listener. And so I try to make eye contact more often. I try to wait in a conversation and not interject, not get too excited. Also learn techniques not to annoy other people when I'm making maybe assertions in conversations. One of my bosses once got a little angry at me because I was making some assertions, and he's like, "Oh, I don't really know if you know that, Warwick. Like, you know, you, it may be based on your experience, but you know, it may not be true, like, you know, for the whole world, and but you're kind of asserting that it is." And so, you know, he said, "I think a better way to make an assertion is to say, in my experience, this is blah 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 blah." And so rather than saying that this is true for the whole world, I'm saying, well, based on everything that I've done today, this is what I've learned and this is what I think the answer is. And so you come across far less confrontational and more like you're sharing something. And, you know, it's a shared learning thing, which is also part of relationship building. So that's really helped me reduce confrontation in conversations and allowed people to open up more and allowed us to go deeper as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. That's a great technique, I think, to, you know, to say what you're thinking and open up the space for discussion rather than, like, you know, just saying what you think and leaving it there. I think that's really great.
Because I'm an extrovert.
Yeah.
So I have to be mindful of the fact that other people are not everybody is an extrovert. And so there's some really important information that everybody has and experiences that everybody has. And so you need to be able to give them the space to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, we're coming pretty close to the end of this interview, Warwick. Time has absolutely flown. But I've got one more question for you, and it's something that I ask all the guests. And that is, what advice would you give someone starting their career in 2022?
Build your network. It may seem hard and a daunting task at the start, and it is, but it's a marathon, not a race. And there are plenty of beautiful, amazing people out there that want to talk to you and that want to share their experiences with you. And don't be afraid to ask them. The worst they can say is no. Literally, that's the worst that they can say. And the best that they can say is, hell yeah, let's go and have a coffee. And then who knows what's going to happen once that happens. So, you know, it's an asymmetric risk, and it's an amazing thing, and you really should be doing that. And I understand that not everyone's an extrovert, and so it's more difficult for others than it is for some of us. But try to fight it, or try to find ways that it can work for you. You know, maybe it's online, maybe it's like pinging someone and asking some questions. You know, it doesn't always have to be face-to-face. Yeah, face-to-face is great to build relationships, but, you know, it doesn't always have to be. There are other ways. There's always another way to solve a problem. So try to innovate, do some reading and figure it out. But, yeah, I think those networks, those relationships, what will hold you strong throughout your career and your life, and it's something that you're job doesn't own. You know, when you leave, you take that with you, and that becomes some of your capital that you can use to improve your life and improve your performance in your role, and just have a, you know, have a nicer life. It's really good. So
yeah,
I encourage everyone to go out and build their network and set yourself some goals, like, okay, each week I'm going to meet one new person, two new people in a certain area. If you're going out to learn about a new industry or a new job or, you know, a new topic, set yourself some goals. I want to meet one person every week for the next 8 weeks, and go and reach out to people and do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great advice, I think, and certainly something that everyone can do, and you know, and something that can really be beneficial. I think you have it in your LinkedIn, but it's something like, you know, worst case, I won't reply, and the best case is up to your imagination. And, you know, exactly. I think that's a great way of putting it.
Yeah. If you're thinking of reaching out, I put it by LinkedIn. If you're thinking of reaching out to me, then, yeah, worst case, I won't reply, and best case, up to your imagination.
Yeah, I think that's so good. thanks so much for the chat today, Warwick. I've learned so much about yourself, and there's so many lessons that we've spoken about today that I think are really, really great for young people today. But if people want to find out more about yourself and connect with you further, where's the best place for them to do that?
Yeah, jump on my LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I know some of you may be rolling your eyes, but, you know, it's just it's where I'm active. So so jump on there and have a look through. You know, I do a lot of posts on there, and that will give you a bit of a flavor for what I'm interested in and if I might be helpful for you. And yeah, read through my profile and make a decision from there.
Fantastic. Well, yeah, thanks so much for chatting today, Warwick.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode with Warwick Donaldson. I hope you got something out of it, and I certainly did. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to the Graduate Theory newsletter. You'll get the episode and my takeaways straight to your inbox every single week. Thanks so much for listening again today, and I look forward to seeing you in the next episode.